Welcome to the Dialogue Studio. This podcast series is hosted by the Ikeda Center for Peace, Learning, and Dialogue. In it, we explore the transformational practice of dialogue and why it is important, especially in this current moment. I'm your host, Lillian Koizumi. In these episodes, you will hear from individuals from all walks of life sharing what dialogue means to them and how they are practicing it in their daily lives. We will also introduce our founder Daisaku Ikeda's philosophy of dialogue and the various approaches and strategies we practice here at the center. For Ikeda, the more severe the challenges we face, the more crucial it is that we persist in dialogue, because dialogue has the power to break down the walls of mistrust, hatred, and division in the hearts of people everywhere. We hope you will join us in this endeavor to transform our world one dialogue at a time. Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for tuning in to the Dialogue Studio today. As you may know, so much has happened in the world since our last episode in October, and we've been having many conversations here at the center about this current moment. What does it mean for all of us? How do we move forward from here? How can we turn to dialogue in these times of uncertainty and division? What are the conversations we want to have but don't know where to start? I imagine many of you are grappling with similar or more questions, and I hope you have at least one good friend to talk to. And always, please feel free to share any of your thoughts with us by emailing podcasts@ikedacenter.org. Because of all of the things I just shared, I'm even more excited to introduce our podcast guest today, Eliza O'Neill, who is a senior curriculum developer at the Constructive Dialogue Institute. Eliza's role at CDI is to create dialogue-focused curriculum, resources, and trainings for students, educators, administrators, and anyone looking to cultivate skills to foster connection across differences in any context. Before joining CDI, Eliza was a program director for Seeds of Peace, where she ran dialogue and facilitation training programs for young adults and educators from around the world. She spent 6 years as a facilitator for Essential Partners, working with communities of all ages looking to bridge divides and connect more meaningfully. Eliza previously taught at experiential high schools in Maine and Colorado and led wilderness trips around the world for groups of young adults. Eliza holds a BA from Bates College and an EDM from the Harvard Graduate School of Education. Eliza and I had this conversation a couple of months ago, and listening to it again now was so helpful and deeply encouraging. She shared her own experience of getting into dialogue work, what does constructive dialogue mean and look like, her insights on the role of dialogue in an increasingly divisive world, inspiring examples of individuals and groups transforming conflicts through dialogue, and so much more. If you want to feel a big dose of hope right now, you are in the right place. I hope you enjoy the dialogue. So Eliza, it's so great to have you on the Dialogue Studio today. Thank you again for taking time. Since you're kind of new to our listeners, I thought if I could invite you to introduce yourself, what are you currently doing for work? And something that I've been thinking about as I meet with people is there's just so much happening right now in the world. And I feel like my mind is so much is taking up my mind space these days, like outside of work, in work, with just personal relationships. So I was just curious for you, what's sort of been on your mind lately? What's sort of most occupying your mind space?
Yeah, it's so good to be here. My name is Eliza O'Neill. I currently work at a nonprofit called the Constructive Dialogue Institute. My role there right now is the senior curriculum developer. And something that's been on my mind lately is actually, I often find myself thinking about creative new ways to gather with friends. I don't know if you've ever read Priya Parker's writing on the art of gathering, but she has a lot of really fun kind of ideas for structuring parties and dinners and that kind of thing. And I just read something from her recently that was all about devising unique names for your gathering, kind of as a way to hook people and get them to show up, which sometimes is like half the battle. And I was just talking to my partner actually about hosting a hot take party where everyone comes with a presentation of some kind about a hot take or about really anything at all, anything that they believe. So it could be like, cheese is overrated, or Thursday is the best day of the week, or we'd be better off with one shape of pasta, I think was one of them we came up with. Maybe controversial, but also lighthearted, and sounds kind of silly. But anyway, I get really inspired thinking about new ways to sort of get people together and spend time together. And at the end of the day, it's probably not that far off from why I get inspired by dialogue as well.
Yeah, I love that. I would love to hear if someone thinks cheese is overrated, I'd love to hear their presentation
I
and
would also
engage in
love
stuff.
to issue some strong
Right.
rebuttals.
Right. I feel like we could have a healthy debate about that.
Exactly.
That's really wonderful. Actually, sort of on a similar note, something that I've been thinking about at one of our recent Dialogue Nights events that we host here, I think we've shared a little bit with you about that program. We've had a lot of youth come who are doing like dialogue events themselves in different spaces. And a lot of young people I've met are doing dialogues in their own homes, like in their apartments. And one of them shared with me that him and his friend, they do this gathering called Listening Nights. And so they invite people, it's of course like limited capacity, but they'll invite people to their apartment and someone gets to sort of bring a struggle or a problem they have and present it to the group. And then folks get to sort of give advice or feedback and sort of talk through this problem together and help this person like solve this issue or sort of maybe take a few steps forward on it or gain new insights on it. So your hot
So
takes
cool.
idea sounds great. And
That
it's so
is so
important.
interesting. I wonder where they came up with that. I actually was just talking to a colleague who has a small group of friends who do learning nights. They sort of wanted sort of to tap into more curiosity and the opportunity to learn new things in their adulthood, which wasn't as common as when they were in school. And so on these sort of once a month gatherings, each person brings some topic of any kind and they do a deep dive into it and kind of teach everybody what they've learned in their research. And they all go around and do that. And so by the end of the day, they might have learned something about like koalas or about, any range of topics that felt interesting to them that month. And I just thought that was such a cool sort of theme.
Yeah, that's so encouraging. I feel like a couple of years ago when I would tell people about, oh, I work at a dialogue center, people would be like, what's that? And like, what do you do? And these days I feel like everybody's like, tell me more. And I can feel this shift in people really seeking these spaces. And so it's great that we get to do the work that we do at this time.
I totally agree. Whenever I feel stressed out and urgent and distressed, I think, this is what people really want and need. A different sort of a reset. It's a watershed moment right now, sort of
Right.
a reset opportunity for us to engage in new ways.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, well, thank you, Eliza. I feel like we've already jumped right into the dialogue. When you came by last time, staff, we were just reflecting how dialogic you are, and it's great to meet people who do dialogue work who are actually dialogic in their real life. And so we enjoy our conversations with you, and we have sort of like a funny encounter story. You know, we met each other all the way in California, only to learn that we're both based in Boston, actually in Cambridge to be specific. And so it was so great to meet you, you know, at Soka University of America and learn about the work that you're doing, which we'll talk about in a little bit. But yeah, I'd love for our listeners to hear how you got involved in dialogue work. You know, I think for myself, when I was in college, I definitely didn't think that I would be working at a dialogue center. I don't even think I knew that that kind of organization existed. So sort of how you got involved in this work and what motivated you to pursue a career in this field?
I'm like you. I did not know that this was a thing when I was in college. I came out of college just not totally sure what I wanted to do. What I had been doing in college and in the summers was a lot of wilderness travel and trip leading. And so from there, I sort of said, let's keep this going. This is what I'm doing right now. So I took a teaching apprenticeship in Colorado, where it was sort of focused around experiential learning for high schoolers in kind of a non-traditional school. The school is called the High Mountain Institute. And I kind of got into it initially because, I loved being outside. I loved the challenge of wilderness travel and living. I loved paying attention to our sort of most fundamental needs, that sort of thing. But then, of course, like most things, like what I took from the job was totally different, which was really about intentional community, and that being the biggest point of learning for most people, no matter what the sort of challenges at hand. So, I kind of went in thinking I'm going to be teaching wilderness first aid and stream crossings, and backcountry cooking and kind of concrete things like that. I really found myself more so facilitating dialogue. I didn't have those terms for it yet, but really I was facilitating students through all the things that happen when we're in small groups. So, managing interpersonal dynamics, building trust, navigating conflict, as they sort of just live together and work together on campus. And so I started to realize that I had the capacity for that. I was like, I think there's something here for me, but I had no idea what I was actually doing. I was really flying by the seat of my pants, like most people in their early 20s out of college. And so I kind of finished that apprenticeship really in pursuit of skills and kind of an understanding of what the modalities for like dialogue or conversation are. So I went to grad school. I basically tried to learn everything I could. I got interested in group counseling. I started attending support groups like Al-Anon and things like that to kind of learn more about group work. I learned about mediation. I started teaching mediation. I did a lot of small claims court mediation in Boston. I did trainings in nonviolent communication. I was part of a summer program for teenagers from South Asia, facilitating kind of conflict transformation processes with them. This was also 2016, so I learned a lot about something called deep canvassing, which is very dialogue-like, sort of all about a way to kind of garner support for political campaigns by using perspective taking and storytelling strategies, stuff like that. What else? I also took improv comedy classes. I took storytelling classes because I sort of saw overlaps with dialogue there too. So you can tell I was a total dialogue obsessed nerd trying to get as much information as I could. And I think one of the takeaways in retrospect was that, all of these different modalities, approaches to conversation basically kind of shared this, the importance of mutual respect and understanding, the importance of just listening deeply to each other, like cultivating spaces for listening, and then really creating environments where people could feel like seen in all their humanity and all their complexity, that kind of thing. So kind of, back to your question, I think what motivated me then is one that I felt like for myself, being connected to dialogue work or dialogue adjacent work of any kind would always challenge me because I really still to this day feel like there is no mastering of dialogue facilitation because it's just so new every time you do it because there's new people in the room. And then the second thing is just the more I dug into it, the more I realized this huge and widespread need for this, for connection, for community. And not just to navigate differences, just in general, people are so disconnected and often feel misunderstood, like everywhere. And I think that, I know that deep connection, human connection is just so fundamental to our health and happiness, but it's just really hard to access in our society, the way we're structured with social media, all of those factors. So I kind of saw dialogue as a way to get around that. So it was really the intersection of my own gratification in this space, but then also the urgent need for the work in the world.
Yeah, that's such a fascinating story, Eliza, of starting in wilderness learning, right? Which I actually don't know much about. So I like put in a note to research a little bit more about that. It sounds really interesting. But I love how sort of from there, recognizing this need for connection as this like foundational aspect of this experience that you had, and then just pursuing it in any way that you could from that point on. And actually, your whole experience reminded me of something that Ikeda said before, where he says we're not born human in any but a biological sense. And he says it's only through dialogue, through engagement with others, do we become fully human. So in a sense, I feel like you were on this journey to sort of deepen your humanity and sort of engage in this process of human becoming. And then sort of how that led to where you are now is really amazing. So yeah, thank you so much for sharing that. Maybe we can sort of jump into your work now. You know, the story and mission behind the Constructive Dialogue Institute is so encouraging and so inspiring. And so I wanted to invite you to share a little bit about the history of the organization, its purpose and mission now, and also if you can unpack for our listeners, you know, what is constructive dialogue?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. CDI does have a really interesting and actually recent history. It was founded by Jonathan Haidt, who's a psychologist, and Caroline Mell, who's our current executive director, in the wake of 2016 of the presidential election. You cannot possibly imagine why, I'm sure. It was just such a fraught time. Mm. Polarization was just front and center for everybody in ways that I don't think a lot of people fully understood was just below the surface. So they sort of came to this problem deeply concerned about polarization. You know, they were sort of starting to see that it wasn't just the sort of old school, we disagree, but instead it was like the other side is the biggest threat to our country, was immoral, was dangerous, was inhuman in some ways. So a part of why they were sort of driven to start CDI is because you know, they both come from research, especially John Haidt. There was so much rich research on what divides us, but they didn't see a lot of places where that research was being translated into practices on the ground in a way that people could actually just use and access in real ways. and so they had this idea to sort of create educational tools that were engaging, that were based in research, that were practical, and then especially that were scalable, given the scale of this problem, in order to kind of spread all of those research-backed insights to, you know, higher ed institutions, to workplaces, religious communities, high schools, governments. And so, so now the sort of headline of CDI is that it's a national nonprofit that builds educational tools to equip Americans with the skills to communicate and collaborate across differences. Mm-hmm. So the whole goal is to help institutions build and sustain these cultures that are based on recognizing our shared humanity, embracing our differences as strengths, and working together to solve our collective challenges. So CDI does this in a few sort of core ways. The biggest one is our e-learning program, Perspectives, which is the scalable part. It's all online. It's 6 lessons. It's asynchronous. We also run professional development with our higher ed partners. The idea being that, you know, campus-wide change can't just happen with students. It has to be campus-wide. We really emphasize that scalability. You know, a big goal of John and Caroline's was scalability. And it's really, the sort of results have really panned out. You know, we've had, I believe up until this point, 50,000 Americans use these tools, this program. Wow. And we've done 2 randomized control trials that for this online program, Perspectives, that tests on a bunch of metrics. So polarization, intellectual humility, and we've seen a shift in reduction of polarization, an increase in intellectual humility, an increase in skills like perspective taking, openness to diverse perspectives, you know, use of conflict resolution skills. So it's really exciting to see some of those goals really bear out. And then you asked about constructive dialogue, which I really appreciate because there are so many different definitions of dialogue. And also I find if you turn on the TV and if you're listening to the news, so many people and politicians are saying like, we need to be in dialogue. And what is it?
Right.
It's so amorphous. So, you know, this is one definition. This is the one that CDI uses. It's one of many possible ones. But the way CDI talks about constructive dialogue is that it's a form of conversation where people with different perspectives try to understand each other without giving up their own beliefs in order to live, learn, and work together. And I appreciate the sort of purpose is rooted in that definition, which is just pursuit of mutual understanding. So not convincing or persuading. And then I also appreciate, and this is sort of newer to me when I came to CDI, which is that embedded in the definition is this idea that we're not trying to give up our own beliefs simply by engaging. Like this is not a consensus building skill necessarily. If participants leave feeling like they understand each other a bit better, that's great, but we're not asking them to change their mind by just engaging. We also have five principles that we use to talk about constructive dialogue. I don't know if that's helpful to sort of unpack the definition a little bit, but this is what we sort of go through when we're starting our trainings. But I really find it sort of helpful to unpack it in a little bit more concrete terms. The first one is let go of winning.
I love that one.
I know, which is it's so hard. It's
It's
like
so
we
hard.
start we started off with the hardest one. The idea that, this is not about a chance to prove the other person wrong, say the thing that's gonna change everyone's mind forever, the mic drop moment or like the lay down the hammer moment that we all like fantasize about, and then you turn on your heel and you walk away and you just told them off and it was so amazing. What we found is that actually, when we focus on winning, people tend to actually dig further into their kind of ideological corners. And instead, if you're focused on learning, being curious, that actually ends up being kind of contagious. Other people then focus on that as well. So the second one is it's what let go of winning and then get curious. That's another thing that goes out the window when conversations get hard. It's so hard to access our honest curiosity when we're in conflict. So what we're trying to do is sort of get people to dig into that curiosity, even if we know that person really well, even if it's so easy to assume. Actually, the better we know someone, the more we tend to assume things about them. Our family members, like, I know where you're coming from right now. I know exactly what your deal is. And what I always tell people is that digging into curiosity, you'll be shocked how much you can learn from people you already know. So we work with faculty and staff, and oftentimes they're like, I know my team, I know my colleagues, and then they come away thinking, oh my gosh, I actually didn't. I learned a lot. And the third principle is share stories. Another just core principle of dialogue. And this comes from, our research-backed work, which is that, research tells us that stories move people emotionally in a way that facts and figures actually, again, make them more entrenched in their original beliefs. So when your meaning-making starts to become triggered, you can actually be heard. You can hear people a little bit more. I think the reason for that is you can start to resonate and relate to elements of people's stories, even if you can't relate to what they're saying exactly or what their belief is. And I share this note because I'm not a great storyteller. I sort of get lost and maybe it rambles a little bit. I lose the plot. And I never want people to feel daunted by the encouragement to tell stories because, people are like, wait, stories are supposed to have, a hook and character development and a narrative arc and maybe a tension or conflict and then a surprise twist and then a conclusion. That's not at all what we're saying. We're sort of saying, just speak from a personal and honest place rather than an intellectual and analytical place. Here's an experience that I have that has informed my belief on this. So that's what we're talking about with stories. And then the fourth principle is navigate conflict with purpose. This is sort of when we talk about the very natural fight, flight, freeze response that so many of us that we all have actually when we perceive a threat. Used to be a bear chasing us, now it tends to be more interpersonal. And so in those moments when we're set off, we often encourage, taking a breath, taking a break, pausing, checking in with yourself, and then staying rooted in the purpose of dialogue, which is to understand and not to sort of change minds. And then finally, the fifth principle is find what's shared, which is which can also be so hard in conflict, but it really just is about acknowledging that commonalities of any kind, can be this glue that holds conversations together. It is not saying that our differences are erased or that they're not important, or denying them. But it's just saying that similarities, whether it's similarities or that are within the disagreement, like, hey, seems like we both care about feeling safe in our country. We're both really concerned about personal liberties being violated. There's that within the conflict, but there's also like similarities that humanizes a little bit. Like, hey, we both practice the same religion. I had no idea. Or we were both identical twins. How about that? Or whatever. It seems small, but I think it can really make people feel connected who are experiencing disconnection. So those are the principles.
Thank you, Eliza. I love the principles, and I love the definition of constructive dialogue and the purpose of it being to find mutual understanding. And I love that you said, that the goal is not to try to give up our own beliefs. And I think about how important that is in our society today. And even like thinking back to 2016, I mean, I still remember how many of my friends expressed that they want to move out of this country because they can't imagine themselves living in this country with people who they fundamentally not just disagree with, but like from a very deep aspect of their life, like can say that they really hate or, would not want to be in the presence of. And so I just remember so many people sort of living in this place of fear and how much anxiety that created for folks in the coming years. And so I feel like even today, like when we think about the ways that we engage with each other, like if we could all, coexist harmoniously, not having to change ourselves, but learn to be, in discomfort, but yet still be able to respect each other as human beings. Like, I feel like it's not something that, we do often, or that, we see often in our society. And that's why we end up in our own bubbles, right? So we never have to feel that discomfort of being challenged in some way. But to gain that skill to be able to engage in a dialogue where I don't have to change my beliefs or change my stance, but I can understand you a little bit more as a human being, is something that I feel like is so needed. And when you talked about sort of dialogue, the definition of dialogue, I was just talking to another scholar recently about how when you're engaging in a debate or an argument, there's always one winner and one loser. Whereas in dialogue, there should be two winners because what you win is sort of this deepening of your humanity and this deepening of mutual understanding. And whether or not you agree, hopefully you grow as a person through your encounter with the other. And so, yeah, I love everything you shared. And I was wondering, Mr. Ikeda talks about how dialogue is this transformative process. Like through dialogue, we can transform some aspect of ourself. And so you've probably worked with many individuals and groups. You talked about higher ed organizations or corporate organizations. Can you share maybe some examples of seeing someone like really, or a group really undergo this like very sort of concrete change? Because I think sometimes people think like, can dialogue really change anything? But I think it's so helpful to hear specific examples of how conflicts are actually transformed through dialogue.
I have one story that sometimes I tell at the beginning of trainings, and that's because it has stuck with me over so many years. That actually did have, it's not often that you have this, like sometimes a transformation happens way later when people leave the room and they reflect back, and it doesn't often happen before our eyes. In this case, it actually did for me. I mentioned that I facilitated these summer dialogue experiences for teenagers from South Asia, from India and Pakistan. And these are countries who were, these students were coming in with a lot of bias against one another's countries, stereotyping, misconceptions. And so the program was kind of about helping them start to unpack their differences and understand where they're coming from, understand each other better a little bit, maybe humanize each other a little bit. And, honestly, it's a really emotionally stressful experience. For students, most of them had never met someone from that other country. Two students in particular got in this really heated back and forth that started one day and went for days. You know, every day we met, and this back and forth would just resume. And it was really tough. It was often tearful between the two of them. And it felt like myself, I had a co-facilitator. We were like at a loss. We introduced new topics. We were trying to like invite other voices. I was relatively new to facilitating. I was like, this is intractable. What are we supposed to do to get past this? The core argument between them was that one shared that Pakistan is a dangerous place, and the other shared that Pakistan was safe. You know, two beliefs that couldn't possibly be true at the same time. So it was just like this cycle back and forth. So finally, one day we tried a new strategy. This is what happens when you're facilitating. You're like throwing something. I'm going to try this today. We had them pause and kind of just state their stances. You know, Pakistan is a dangerous place. Pakistan is a safe place. We then asked them to sort of dig more into where they were coming from. Tell us more about where you're coming from, why you care so much about this, what's at stake for you. So one was sharing more about how her grandmother was affected by a school bombing. She'd been told her whole life that Pakistan was dangerous, that there's security everywhere for a reason. Shared more specifics. The other then shared about his experience, you know, walking down the street and feeling safe, going through security at school and feeling safe, walking at night and feeling safe. How could this be a dangerous place? I live there. I know. And then we had them repeat back to each other, you know, it sounds like your family has told you that Pakistan is a dangerous place. Is that right? Yes. It sounds like you actually feel safe in your country. Is that right? Yes. So just what they heard. Not the sort of not necessarily paraphrasing or reading into it, just what they heard. And so then, as facilitators, we sort of took a stab at lifting up some sort of shared values that we were hearing, anything that was shared within that disagreement. They both were really concerned about safety. They both were really committed to truth, that their family's stories were true. And then they both were in this space, very preoccupied and concerned about being legitimate and fair representatives of each of their nations in this kind of multinational context. That meant a lot to both of them. And I think that was part of what contributed to like so much escalation. And then we sort of adjourned for the day. The next day, we asked them if they wanted to discuss more. And they were like, no. And we were like, I can't believe this. It had completely diffused. You know, they had expressed themselves and been heard. They had found a few things in common, and they could just sort of go forward. Like their views hadn't necessarily changed, but the chance to just be heard, understood, had totally de-escalated this, what felt like an impossible back and forth originally. So for me, I was like, these were actually pretty simple moves. That it was, you know, it was like being heard, facilitating the hearing, lifting up these shared values, giving them a space to express a little bit more and be understood a little bit more, had just transformed the nature of this conflict. Obviously, it wasn't over for them. It wasn't totally that simple, but it was for me like, oh my God, these are actually pretty simple strategies. And this was a really, really hard interaction. So it kind of showed me the power of, you know, these strategies and in kind of cultivating people's ability to be in community and relate to each other. Like I think about it a lot. They went on to be partners for different activities, and they were friends with each other. I mean, I know that's sort of a Pollyanna sort of conclusion. I don't like to focus on that because it doesn't always happen that way, and that's okay. But it was a real transformation that we witnessed.
Yeah, that I mean, that's such a powerful example, Eliza. And I think about, you know, if we could replicate, of course, every situation is different, but if we could just create more spaces where two people could come together, two people from completely opposing views could come together and have this kind of dialogue. You know, if I just thinking
I
about
know.
our country and if we just, you know, I don't know how we would do that, you know, but I mean, you're doing this work and of course we're trying to do it here at the center, but hearing that one example is so hopeful because, you know, it was simple in that you had the space, you brought these two folks together and then sort of you had these questions or prompts for them to simply be able to be heard, as you said, and then find a way to acknowledge each other as human beings. You know, I feel like sometimes it's so easy to dehumanize people that we don't have to speak face to face to, and we just see or hear about on the news or see on social media. But to actually have to confront another human being in front of you, and then to have to recognize, wow, we do have these shared experiences. You know, this person is a human being, and they have a valid point. And maybe there's something about my opinion that could maybe be changed, even if just a little bit. But without that encounter, we won't be able to go through that process. So, yeah, I think, wow, if we could do that many, many times and many, many places, I feel like our society would look very different.
I know. And it's messy. It's like, oh, that's really inconvenient to have fully humanized that person because that was really tidy box.
Right.
And hold on, what does this mean about this other person that I've alienated myself from? And like, wait a minute, suddenly it's kind of a notice from students that I work with who have that realization that the person in front of me is not exactly who I thought that they were, or who I've been told that they were. And like, uh-oh,
yeah,
that's inconvenient. That's really complicated and uncomfortable. And so it's understandable to want to, disengage because it becomes really uncomfortable when you realize that there's humanity to everybody.
Yeah. I mean, that is such a real aspect of being a human, even in the, like, especially in the context of, like, I think about our families, right? Like how many sort of estranged family members you hear about. I mean, even within my own family, you know, and you just know that if I just let myself hear that person's experience or opinion, that there might be a chance that I could be wrong. And that you hold, you know, you don't want to go there, you know, because as you said, that opens, you know, a whole like aspect of you having to sort of be honest with yourself and be open to growing in a way that you maybe were not planning to, or that challenges you in ways that can be painful too, you know. And I, as we were talking about this, Eliza, I just thought of something, just like your role as facilitators in that situation. I wonder, as a facilitator, like how much sort of inner work do you have to do as a facilitator to kind of continue? I mean, of course, it's part of your job and you have to be there and you have these strategies that you're implementing. But I imagine that it was stressful also for you as a facilitator. And like, is there any sort of inner tension that you go through in terms of believing in the dialogue itself? Or is there anything that comes up in the process of being a facilitator that has required you to grow or challenge you in ways that you weren't expecting when you got into like facilitation work?
Yeah, I mean, I talk about that instance. During that time, I had a co-facilitator who I trusted implicitly and who I would have, you know, the two of us would leave those dialogues having, you know, in some ways pushed down our strong reactions to what we were hearing, and tabled them and said, this is not about us. This is about facilitating this process. You know, we always say like facilitating is rooted in facile, which is a French word, make easier. So it's sort of, we're doing this in a little bit in service to, the student process. And that was only made possible by these long debrief conversations that we would have following. What did I miss in that? How did that land for you? What did you interpret that thing that student said? Did I hear that wrong? And so constantly checking ourselves, also on our sort of gaps in what we're perceiving. You know, everybody, I know I'm a big believer, nobody's neutral. We bring in all this stuff swirling around that causes real gaps in the way we're perceiving what we're hearing and taking it on board. And so having a co-facilitator is a huge part of learning and growing yourself and what you're missing and how you're coming across and how you're sort of wielding or sharing power. All of that is a constant dance and conversation. And it's also very, you know, you have to have so much humility. But that's part of what I'm talking about when I'm talking about how this is a never ending challenge, that this work, no matter how experienced I get, will always be a challenge, but in a really good way that I feel like I'm always growing from and sort of stretching. And
yeah, Yeah, thank you for sharing that, Eliza. And yeah, it's like you and your co-facilitator are simultaneously engaging in dialogue, and as you support, the people that you're serving to engage in the same process. So, maybe this is a good segue to this next question I have. So I don't know if you hear this a lot, but these days I feel like a lot of times, whether it's in the news or in my conversations, maybe with younger folks more so than older, but I think just across the board, there's this feeling of like, I don't want to talk anymore. Like, we're done talking. Like, we just want to see change. We just want to take action. And yet, us who do dialogue, I think there's this belief that, even though it's a slower transformation, that genuine change can only happen through dialogue and through sort of, as you shared earlier, developing mutual understanding among people. And so this sort of ties into this quote that I shared with you before our interview today from Ikeda, where he says, "In this time of severe trial, humanity must take the first step on the path of courageous dialogue, which will connect people heart to heart and pool their wisdom. Open dialogue is the only way peaceful coexistence will occur. It will transform prejudice to understanding, mistrust to empathy, and conflict to harmony." So, yeah, I was just wondering from your perspective, what do you feel like is the role of dialogue in these times, especially when it's just a time of extreme conflict, and we have one conflict in one part of the world, and then another conflict emerges, and then on top of that, of course, there's conflicts that we face every single day, in our own country, in our immediate environment. And so, how do you see the role of dialogue? How can we use dialogue day to day? And then, and sort of going back to my original sentiment about how people are feeling about dialogue these days, like, how do you talk to folks who are skeptical about dialogue?
Yeah, I mean, being discouraged and hopeless right now is so valid. I feel it. There's polarization being used as a political strategy, politicians running on like the premise that the other person will ruin the country.
Right. That's like their
And
campaign strategy.
right. And as soon as that, if they get elected, then which so many are, then we become deeply entrenched in that polarization because then they're in the office because of that.
Right.
There's that. There's like obviously media, social media like highlights these extreme views because they get more clicks. And so we actually have this distorted vision of what the average American thinks. And then of course there's one of the things I hear so much is this like, I'm not going to speak up because we have this culture of shutting down one another if we mess up. So, people feel like they're walking on eggshells, they're worried about saying the wrong thing. People just stay silent. Like it's so valid to want to just stay out of it.
Right.
But I think what we often say is there's this amazing there's a research group called More in Common, who's just has so many amazing resources on their website. But they found recently that two-thirds, I think it's 67% of Americans are fed up with division, want to talk, want to learn from each other, want to find common ground, want to address, society's problems together. Actually, More in Common calls them the exhausted majority, which I'm like, love that name. Same. All that is to say, dialogue is the way to meet that moment. Like people want to engage with their differences and understand better. Like that's what dialogue is designed to do. And I think that I want to point out something that I think is really helpful in my mind because I think it's important to situate dialogue within the broader picture of that work towards, more just, inclusive, belonging societies. Because frankly, like, yeah, genuine peace is really far away right now. And that's real, right? Like, so what I mean by situating it in the larger picture is like, we can't solve these problems without a shared understanding of what the problems even are, which we don't even have right now. So we can't like aspire to build these diverse societies characterized by belonging until we actually see it in these small ways. And so, I often get this, like, especially from students, like, we're just sitting in a room together. This is inaction, actually. But I think that it's critical to understand before you get to decision making, solution finding, like community building, activism, policy changing, like creating the world we want to see through real action cannot sufficiently happen until we understand the problem together, and understand each other and like break down the walls. And so, I think about this. I actually once had a student liken the pursuit of peace through dialogue to building cathedrals. I was like almost moved to tears. He was like, this makes me think of how when people were building cathedrals, it took hundreds and hundreds of years to complete. So like far longer than one person's lifespan, many, many, many generations, especially back then. But it just took this faith that each generation will like pass the baton and continue the work, even though you just need to come to terms with never really seeing the results or maybe never seeing the results. And I think, I really appreciated that, especially from a young person who has had this kind of really long game perspective. Pretty great. And also, humbling. But it's nice to have a little dose of reality because we can sort of, we can sort of appeal to our high ideals of utopia and peace and these societies of belonging. And sometimes I can see the disengagement because it just feels so far away. So I think you asked about advice about sort of how to access that kind of thing. I would say the first thing is start small. I can often get precious about dialogue being in this like beautifully crafted formal space where we act differently than we do in our day-to-day, and we're facilitated by professional facilitators, and there are boundaries and structures. And actually, at the end of the day, dialogue is just a conversation, and we have access to conversations all the time. And so I think what I would say is like within those existing conversations, like people new to you, people you've known forever, there's these tried and true ways that we can use dialogue. We can ask questions from a genuinely curious place. Like you share more about where you're coming from. What makes you say that? Like, why is this so important to you? So just assuming that we can always learn something new from each other. Listening for strengths in each other and values that you're hearing. We often talk about something called fundamental attribution error, which is a really ridiculously wordy n name for basically a cognitive bias where we tend to blame other people's actions on their character, but attribute our own behaviors to just the situation at hand. So, someone cuts me off in traffic and I'm like, that person is a jerk fundamentally. I cut them off in traffic and I'm like, oh my God, I'm late for work. What was I supposed to do? I had no choice. So, using kind of this strengths-based lens to try to see the best in people is a big part of this. And really doing that, sharing on the basis of like the values that drive us, that are legitimate, that we care about fairness. We care about loyalty and friendship and safety and things like that. So trying to share on the basis of those. And then I think something that, we're talking about really big problems and really huge issues that, really get us down. And I think that what I would say is not underestimating the value of fun in forging connections. It doesn't always have to be these like deepest, darkest hopes and fears. Like levity can do a ton of work for us in building trust, building connection. And it's not just, I will like take this to my grave. Like it is not just throwaway icebreaker activities or chit chat about our weekends. Like it is valuable time that like actually gets to who we are. Could be an activity, a game, a different type of gathering, like we were talking about at the beginning of our conversation. A walk and talk, an art class, like whatever it is. And I love that you started this conversation with a bit of an icebreaker, like what's on my mind lately? Because it assumes that I'm not just my job or this topic, that other parts of my life are swirling around in the mix too. So getting to that, in these interactions, I just really appreciate that.
Thank you for all of that, Eliza. And I actually earlier today I was just reading on our website. Mr. Ikeda engaged in a number of dialogues, and one of them was with this ed scholar. His name is Jim Garrison. And Jim talks about actually this pl this sort of playfulness in dialogue that you just talked about. And I thought mm-hmm. you might appreciate what he says. So in this dialogue with Ikeda, Jim, he said, "We must engage in dialogue if we are to transform disharmony into harmony, but that means recognizing creative possibilities. It's important that participants in dialogues across differences strive to understand one another's beliefs, values, and ways of life sympathetically. However, substantial understanding is often not possible. Nonetheless, the novel meaning we create together sometimes forms mutual understanding, or at least constitutes a willingness to continue. It is important to retain a certain amount of respectful playfulness, by which I mean everything from cheerful banter and simply enjoying one another's company to exploring possibilities, all the while constantly respecting one another's difference." And so I just, when I read it, I just laughed at respectful playfulness. That's so, you know, it's something to, yeah, that I don't practice often when I'm engaging in sort of these serious dialogues. And I feel like we have to, you know, get somewhere or have some kind of resolution, but just like the fact that we're engaging with one another in and of itself has value. Mm-hmm. So yeah, what you said reminded me of that. And I love the cathedral example you shared. That was so moving from your student. Actually, my wife and I were just in Italy, and I remember just looking at these cathedrals and thinking like, yeah, how is this humanly possible? Like who made this? But to see the beauty of it and to, you know, remember through your student that this happened over 100 or, you know, more than 100 years. And then now we sort of can see what human beings are capable of. And that is a great reminder of what dialogue can create, you know, if we continue to do it, you know, over and over again.
I know. Yeah. What a sort of physical representation of this sort of just radical hope and this right. sort of the human spirit saying, I'm not going to see the end of this, but I'm going to contribute to it.
Yeah.
Even though it's backbreaking work, you know, right. It's amazing.
Yeah. But it's true, especially when you think about, you know, and I also appreciated the way you, sort of painted a picture about this current moment we're in and with the election. And I think, you know, you think of this time as a time where, you know, you choose a side and then you hope your side wins. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of what everybody is focused on. But I think it's a great reminder you shared with us that, is that really the goal? And will that really sort of solve the issues that we face now? You know, what will happen after the election? Of course, one side will win technically, but then what do we do with us as human beings? Like, how does that change our society? Does it, you know? And so to think about what are the important things to focus on now, and no matter what laws or governments change, like if we don't change as human beings, then we sort of fall into this same cycle, right? So that was a great reminder for me, Eliza. Thank you. Yeah.
Beautiful.
Yeah. So I know we have just a few minutes left. So I didn't include this in my list of questions to you, but something you said made me want to ask you this. You acknowledge that genuine peace is far away, which is very true, and that there's so many reasons to feel hopeless these days. And so I sometimes ask this to our guests is, what is something that, you know, gives you hope? May not be every day, but at times when you feel despair and when you feel hopeless and you know that genuine peace is far away, like what's something that gives you hope, or how do you sort of encourage yourself to continue the work that you're doing?
Wow. I mean, I think it's, you know, connecting like we are right now, connecting with people doing the work that really resonates with me. And then getting to meet students and all of the educators who support them and who are trying to use these skills in their work, in their teaching, in their student support on campuses. You know, I think it's just people trying, people just sort of, you know, being discouraged and still trying to understand and entering into these really uncomfortable spaces when it's for many people, easier to disengage. And I think that just the right now, there's a lot of urgency to sort of get to quote unquote the table. Yeah. This is a, this is a watershed moment after October 7th, after with the election coming up. There is a lot of urgency and an understanding of the urgency of this moment. And I think I just am so, so grateful when I see full packed rooms of people and students, making their voices heard and showing up, with all of their concerns and all of their messiness. And that really gives me hope. And then I think, seeing people use these types of strategies in their everyday lives. We're coming up on Thanksgiving in the US. People are like, how am I supposed to even begin to do this? And so, we get questions like that. And I'm like, what an amazing thing to want to bolster yourself with some skills to understand your uncle at the Thanksgiving table as opposed to shutting him down. You have to look at small moments of using these skills and trying them on and pushing yourself through the discomfort of it. And I think that's what gives me hope. I mean, students always give me so much hope. I am so grateful to still have a touch point with students in my job because if you're ever discouraged, like something like that cathedral anecdote will just be dropped into your life and you're like, what? Okay, I feel great about things actually, as it turns out. So that helps a lot to be connected with students.
That was beautiful, Eliza. Thank you. I feel that way every time we host Dialogue Nates and the young people come in and they just see the world in a way that, I've sort of over time I've forgotten that, these possibilities exist in the world, and they remind us of that. That's why, we need young people.
Absolutely. Yeah. And they're ready. They are ready to
That's
be
so
in
true.
conversation and to grapple to with us and with each other. And that's really impressive and really cool.
Yeah, that's so true. Well, thank you so much, Eliza, for this wonderful conversation. I learned so much, and it gave me a lot of hope and a lot of things to think about. And so, yeah, I hope we can talk again soon. But thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Lily. And it's always so good to connect with you.
Thank you for joining us in the Dialogue Studio today. I hope you're leaving with some helpful and meaningful takeaways. If you want to learn more about Eliza's work, check out the Constructive Dialogue Institute's website, constructivedialogue.org. We'll also link to it in the episode description. If you're interested in learning more about the Ikeda Center for Peace, Learning, and Dialogue, you can visit our website at ikedacenter.org or follow us on social media at Ikeda Center. Stay tuned for our final episode of the year, where I'll reflect on 2024 with our Executive Director, Kevin Marr. Thank you again, and until next time, happy dialoguing.